So, anyway. So last time we started getting into some pretty good stuff, and we started talking about special relativity. And in special relativity, there are two basic postulates. One is that the speed of light is constant for all observers. And this is completely counterintuitive, but it does agree with observation, actually. And it, I think it would be a mistake historically if I left you with the impression that Einstein created the special theory of relativity in response to Michelson and Morley's experiments, which found the constancy of the speed of light. I did dig into that a little bit. It is probable that he was aware of those experiments, but it is, from what I've read, it seems that he was really bothered by some aspects of light anyway. I mean, he asked questions like, if I could run at the speed of light, what would light look like? I mean, and there were other issues which I'll get to a little bit as we get into electricity and magnetism, but electricity and magnetism was pretty well understood by the time Einstein was came out with the special theory of relativity, but it had some very fundamental problems that I'll point out to you. And in fact, his initial paper was called On the Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies. So its main focus was actually more on electromagnetism than on space and time stuff. So, but that said, fundamental postulate in special relativity is that the speed of light is constant for all observers. And that's really the thing that makes it go. And that's the thing that makes it, I mean, it's completely counterintuitive. The other thing, I think, is just a no-brainer because science doesn't work if you don't have it, which is that sort of whatever happens physically happens in all frames of reference. You may perceive it to be different, but physically, if an egg breaks, it breaks for everybody, that sort of thing. So these are the two basic postulates. And I say across all inertial frames of reference. So there's a very particular constraint that's used in the theory, the special theory of relativity. The word special refers specifically to inertial frames of reference, which basically means non-accelerating frames of reference. So the special theory of relativity is a theory that relates observations across to different points of view where those points of view are moving at a constant velocity with respect to one another. Okay? And complications happen if you allow acceleration. So if you allow someone to turn or speed up, then things get different. So when we looked at this last time, we used a particular example where we had some truck going by and there was an event on the truck, which is a beam of light, was sent up, hit a mirror, came back down. And we compared what would be seen by an observer who is moving with respect to the truck, where they would basically see the light go straight up and straight down, and they would measure a time. And we compared that to what an observer on the ground would see if the truck were moving fast relative to the speed of light. So some reasonable fraction of the speed of light, which of course no truck can do, so this is a ridiculous thing, but you can sort of mentally imagine it. And if that were true, then if this truck is moving as the light moves upward, if the light's going to bounce off the mirror moves from the time the light is emitted, the mirror moves to here, and then when it bounces back, the mirror has moved to here. So basically the light has to follow such a path to someone who is on the side of the road. Okay, if the height is the same in both cases, you can just look at this and you can see that this path length is longer. If the speed of the light, speed being distance divided by time, if the speed is the same for this light and that light, and the path length is longer here, then the person on the side must perceive this event to take more time. Otherwise, the speeds couldn't be the same. So if that is true, then the person to the side of the road and the person on the truck have to perceive time as moving at different speeds, if you will. Time is moving more slowly on the truck than it is on the side of the road, because on the side of the road they need to have a bigger number. More time has to have passed in order for them to have the speed of light be the same. So you okay with that? As much as you can be? All right. So, I mean, this is very strange, but it appears if you assume the constancy of the speed of light, which seems to be this experimental fact, then time is relative. And there's no way out of that box. So then you might ask, do you believe it? And there are lots of examples. I think I mentioned one. Quite literally, they took, you can take very precise synchronized clocks, separate them, put one on an airplane, send it around the world, and although it's going a small fraction of the speed of light, in fact, when you bring them back together, those clocks will read different numbers, and that the numbers that they read are in agreement with relativity. It's a little more complicated than just what we're talking about in particular, because if you're on an airplane, you're going to accelerate. I mean, you start off at zero, you accelerate, you go up, you're constantly changing direction. So it's not actually just a special relativity problem. To give you a sense of how complicated that can be, you are very often in accelerated reference frames, right? If you get on an elevator and you press the button and it starts moving, what do you feel?
Force.
You feel a force, for sure. How do you perceive it?
Well, if you're like going up, you feel lighter.
If you're going up, you feel heavier.
Vice versa.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, if you're going down, you feel lighter. I mean, if you go to a really tall building that has really fast elevators, I mean, it will leave your stomach up there, right? When it starts going down, you'll get the butterflies and the whole bit because you feel like you're falling. And when it starts at the bottom, I mean, you feel like you ate way too much over vacation or something, right? I mean, you get a lot heavier. So that's what happens in accelerated reference frames. And Einstein did, I mean, we're going to talk more about it, but Einstein did what Einstein always does, which is he does some simple little observation, like on an elevator or whatever, and then makes this big deal out of it. So what he said was, well, you're on an elevator, and if there's no window, how can you tell that the elevator is accelerating versus maybe Earth got a lot bigger and the gravitational force of Earth is just a little bit more for that moment? Right, philosophically, that makes, you know, it makes no sense. But if you're on this elevator and it is accelerating upward, you feel heavy. And how can you tell the difference between that and the gravitational force of the Earth on you? And Einstein said, you can't. And then he used that and built the general theory of relativity out of that. So we're going to talk more about that. So for problems that involve acceleration, you actually have to use the more complicated version of relativity, which took him another 10-ish years to figure out after 1905. It wasn't released until about 1915, because the mathematics is much worse. But this is one example. I mean, the truth is you can do experiments where acceleration has nothing to do with it, and you can show that it agrees with special relativity to a gnat's eyebrow. And You know, if you're really curious about that, I can give you a reference. There's a guy named Clifford Will, who's at Washington University, actually, who compiles a big review of all experiments that test relativity from year to year. And it's massive. He's now got it on the web, and I guess I could have given you, maybe I'll send you the link, but I mean, it's all technical stuff, but it's outrageous how many tests there have been and to what high precisions that they've been done, and everything agrees very well with relativity. So as strange as it seems, it appears to agree with observation. So we did an example last time that shows how perverse it can be when you sort of take it and put it in everyday life. And we'll come back to some of these perverse things, but let me move on a little bit. The first example that we did an example where the truck is moving this way and the person in the truck, the beam of light went straight up. In other words, it was at right angles to the motion of the truck. So you could imagine doing the same experiment, but now having the beam of light go in the direction of the truck's motion. Okay? And so here's the event. You have the beam of light going, hitting the front of the truck, and coming back to the back of the truck. And what I'd like to do is to imagine that you're on the truck and you measure this, and that you're beside the truck and you measure it. Okay? And again, well, so now the question is, if you know the speed of light and you know how much you measure, how much time it takes, you could measure, for example, the length of the truck, because then you would know how far it goes. And so in this case, these are your two points of view. You're on the truck or you're beside the truck as the light goes. So remember, in the case where you're beside the road, as this light is moving, the truck is moving. So this light doesn't hit the front of the truck here where it was when the light was emitted. It hits it where it is when it finally gets there. And then when it comes back, as it's moving back, the back of the truck has moved up, right? So this is one path, and this is the other path. And now last time I showed you, you know, the basic algebra that you could use to deconstruct these different paths and actually relate the two times. You can play the same game here, and I won't bother showing you the algebra, but when you do it, what you find is that the length of the truck along the direction of motion, if you are at rest with respect to the truck, is a certain length. But if it is zooming past you at a high rate of speed, when you look at it, you would see it contracted along its direction of motion. So if I were to take a ball and hold it here, right, it would look round to you. But if I were some super, you know, baseball pitcher and could throw it at a large fraction of the speed of light, as it went by, you would perceive it looking more like a pancake. And this is called length contraction. All right, I'll come back to this. So the first thing that we've seen is called time dilation, and now we're seeing length contraction. And yes.
How exactly does this length contraction work? I don't know. It seems pretty abstract.
It is. How does time dilation work?
What travels like because the velocity equals the distance over the time, it travels like a greater distance because the velocity is constant, so the time estimate.
Right. So I mean, I can take you through the derivation of the length contraction. I mean, I'm not ready to do it right now, but I mean, I can do it. I can show you the algebra. Basically, you take, you use the length of time you measure for the light to go, and the constancy of the speed of light, and you determine the distance. And when you do that and you solve for the distance in the two reference frames, eliminating the two different times, using the relationship between the times that we just got for this path, then you end up with a relationship between the lengths that...
You say, you mean like length is, as in like distances?
Space is relative to, is what I'm trying to say. It depends on your point of view.
Okay.
Just like time does. So I'll pull this together a bit more, but yeah.
The speed of light is absolute, right? It's always going to go at that speed. What if you had a truck like going in the opposite direction, like 9/10 the speed of light, and then you shine a light the opposite direction?
Okay, so you could ask, for example, I have a truck going 0.6 times the speed of light this way, and a truck going 0.6 times the speed of light that way. What is their relative speed? Because you would add it up, it'd be like 1.2 times the speed of light, and you go, wait a minute, you can't do that. That's a great question. To get at that, you have to understand how velocities transform in different reference frames, and so what you're really asking is, if I'm at rest, I see a truck moving 0.6 times the speed of light this way and a truck moving 0.6 times the speed of light that way, and now I transform myself to the reference frame of one of the trucks, you would think it'd be coming at me 1.2 times the speed of light. But in the mathematics of that transformation, it turns out not to be that way. It turns out to be a bigger fraction of the speed of light, but not,
So the speed, like, if you had a car going the speed of light and then you try to light up back, it's not like the light would actually be going 0 miles an hour, like, at rest.
Right. And but that particular problem is sort of ill-defined in relativity. You can't actually have the car going the speed of light. But even if it were going 0.999999 times the speed of light, and you shine the light forward or backward, you would measure the speed of that light to be c relative to you, even though you're moving that fast, which is completely wacko, but that's the way it is. It is beyond the scope of this class for me to go through the derivations of the relative velocity and do that particular problem that you ask. It's a good question, and I'm not trying to blow it off, but if any of you have any interests and you want, I mean, feel free to come by office hours or email me and I can give you that. I mean, it is algebra. It's not, it's not some fancy thing that you have to be a junior math major to understand. But, you know, it is a bit tedious, and so it's not for this class, just not something I will drag you through unless you want to do it voluntarily, I guess. Let me put it that way. But it's an interesting question. All right, so time gets dilated and space gets contracted, but if I'm on the truck, the person beside me looks like they're flying by, and I feel like I'm at rest. If I'm beside the truck is zooming by, and I'm at rest. So who gets dilated, or who gets contracted, because it's really just a point of view thing? There is a way to figure that out. There is a special reference frame for every event. And that is the reference frame where whatever it is you're measuring is at rest. Okay? So in the case of the truck moving, the event where the light goes up and comes back is basically at rest in the frame of reference of the truck. Right? Because you're moving with that event. So it looks like it's basically at rest. The light is emitted and comes back to the same point. We call that the proper frame of reference. It's the special frame of reference. Any other frame of reference, any other point of view of somebody, will be moving with respect to that. So it turns out that is the event, that is the frame of reference where whatever it is you're measuring in that frame of reference has the shortest time. Any other frame of reference would measure that same event to be a longer time. In the frame of reference of measuring the truck length, again, the length of the truck is at rest with respect to the person on the truck. That's the special one. That's where the meter stick is at rest and you just measure it, okay? Any other reference frame, the meter stick is zipping by you. And in the frame of reference of the thing you're measuring, we call that the proper frame, that length is the longest, and it becomes shorter if you're in a different frame of reference and you're looking at it. So you ask, is it really shorter? It is what you measure. In the frame of reference where it's at rest, it's yay long. If you're in any other frame of reference and you measure it, it will look much shorter. So if you go down and you measure the length of Favre's football field, along the length of it, it'll be 100 yards. But in any other reference frame, if they were to measure it, they would measure it to be shorter than 100 yards. And the degree to which it would be shorter is by a factor of this gamma. Remember, this gamma is this strange 1 over square root of 1 minus V over C quantity squared. And the closer you are to the speed of light, that number becomes big. And so if you're moving at 98% the speed of light and zipping past Favre's football field, your gamma factor is a factor of 5, I think, at that point. You would measure that football field, if you were to measure it, to be 20 yards long. Everything would look all compressed, sort of, in that direction. It would have all the lines, but it would look 20 yards long to you. Is it really 20 yards long? It is in your reference frame. It's just like this whole time thing is very real. Every aspect of the perceived time on the spaceship relative to Earth is slower. Heart beats slower, atoms move slower, everything is perceived to be slower, and it's very real. And it is as real on that spaceship as it feels real on Earth. What happens, this weirdness happens when you are trying to relate the observations from one reference frame to another. It's not that there is a right answer. There is a special answer, which is the answer in the reference frame of the thing at rest. But the answers in all these different reference frames are right. That's what you measure. You okay? All right. This length contraction is a little bit weird. It only happens along the dimension, which is along the direction of motion. Transversely, nothing happens. It all looks the same. That's why the ball going by looks like a pancake. It gets compressed in that way. Okay. So, when we started this discussion, I believe we all agreed on a very absolute vision of our universe, and that was there are three immutable dimensions of time, of space, moving lockstep through time in a universal sense for all of us, regardless of our motion. And it turns out that that's just complete crap. It works for us because gamma is one if relative velocities are small compared to the speed of light. So long as we don't have cars and airplanes that are moving a significant fraction of the speed of light, we don't really have to worry about this. But if you have to do something that's very high precision, you do have to worry about this. So we have yet to really talk much about general relativity, but for the GPS system to work that you all sort of know and love these days, and actually it's more than just finding your way to the grocery store or your friend's house, it's actually really important for transportation and military uses, right? This whole global positioning system. I mean, imagine... Well, let me ask you. What... If you were president of the United States and worrying about things on a geopolitical level, what does the GPS system mean to you? Yes?
Security surveillance.
Absolutely. You can do a lot with that.
And kind of like global supremacy and dominance and insecurity surveillance in the United States.
Yeah. Anything else? What do you mean by global security surveillance?
Like if you want to conduct any sort of surveillance on another country, like if we wanted to gain ground information on, you know, what's going on in Iran, for example, if we wanted to observe their nuclear program, we could see it from space.
That's true. So those would be observation satellites, like telescopes in space that are able. Yeah, I'm talking about the global positioning thing. Do you? No, don't. That's okay. I mean, because there are a lot of security considerations. So it's not obvious to me that what you said was not perfectly true. Yes.
Coordinate like troop movements on a whole new level, basically.
Yeah. If everybody's got a GPS and they're all talking to each other. See, what you get with a GPS is you can know where you are, and I don't even know what the current accuracy is, but within like a meter as a function of real time in three dimensions in reality. So your general can sit there and press a button and see where everybody is within a meter. I've never controlled a battle before, but I could. Everything that I've heard historically, a lot of the problem is you don't know quite where everybody is, and that's the problem. I mean, that's a big deal. Imagine if your president. Do you remember the Balkans conflict about 10 years ago? What happened? That's okay. It's your day. Go for it.
The United States. Are you talking about the United States or in general?
Well, in the Balkans, they were all at war with each other, and Yugoslavia and NATO.
Yeah, basically, it was the collapse of Yugoslavia, and certain nationalities within the country were battling for supremacy, but eventually NATO stepped in and kind of heralded.
And how did NATO force that?
With GPS technology and kind of like knowing exactly where people were, because it's a very mountainous region, so they, instead of just like sending ground troops in to just like, you know, tear everyone apart, they kind of were very much more strategic in terms of their.
It was an air campaign. It was a very strategic air campaign. They bombed Yugoslavia, taking out very particular pieces of the infrastructure and military infrastructure until they decided to give up. But that was only capable because it's only possible if you have weapons that have precision guidance. I mean, there are lots of things militarily you would never do because of this terribly cleansed phrase, collateral damage. Right? I mean, if you have to level a city to get a bad guy, most people won't do it. But if you have the option of sending a bomb in and taking out the bad guy and hurting very few other people, possibly, then it's a totally different ballgame. And so militarily, GPS and other smart weapons, guided weapons, actually allow you to do that. So you can put a GPS on a cruise missile, and basically the cruise missile can know where it is and can adjust where it is to make sure that it goes inside the right window of the right building before it blows up. Now, you can still screw up your targeting, and you can have the wrong list, and good people may be in that room, you know, so it's not a clean affair. But the fact that you have that capability changes the whole geopolitical view of things if you're a military person, I think. So that you can only do because of relativistic corrections in the timing that you get from different satellites. So as one statement is, you don't ever have to worry about relativity. But the truth is, it actually is affecting your life right now, because GPS system really does affect everybody's life. And it's a very big thing. And it only works because of relativistic corrections. Okay, so both space and time are different from what we grow up believing them to be. And things are a little more complicated than that, because I won't drag you through it, but we have looked at two examples, and if I threw the math at you, they're sort of designed to pull out just the time piece or just the space piece. But of course, life is more complicated than that. What you really have is that you could be in some reference frame and you measure some event to happen, okay? A grenade blows up. It will happen at some position and at some time, and that's what you would measure it to be. And in relativity, what you want to do is relate that to what someone else might measure. So if someone else is moving with respect to this event, they might measure it to take place at X prime, Y prime, Z prime at some time T prime. So these two people just completely independently measure this thing, okay? And relativity is all about taking the measurements from one point of view and asking, what would somebody from this point of view see, and vice versa. And so that's what this is all about. And it turns out that when you do that transformation, this is the set of equations that you get. This is gamma, so this is the quantity that if this relative motion is large compared to the speed of light, this quantity becomes very big. It is the quantity that's 1 if this velocity is small. Okay? And there's a reason I wanted to show you these equations. If we take these measurements, the person moving who measures this event, we have the position and the time, the position and the time. And now you ask, what position and time are measured by this person in relativity? What I wanted to point out was that the position along this dimension measured by this person depends on the position and the time measured by this person. And the time measured by this person depends on the time and the position measured by this person. So space and time get all mixed up when you make a transformation from one reference frame to another. They are not at all independent like we think of them as being. For us, you measure something in space, and everything is moving lock, stock, and barrel through time in one dimension, in one direction. But in relativity, the space coordinate and the time coordinate get all mixed up when you're trying to relate measurements from one reference frame to another. So this creates a lot of weirdness. And in fact, it means that space and time are not at all dependent. And I guess I was going to make the point, you know, why is this important? I mean, one reason it's important is science as a whole is a science of making observations and relating those observations between people. Well, people are moving with respect to one another, so this is really a core issue for science as a whole. But the thing I wanted to point out was that space and time are getting all mixed up, so we no longer really can talk about space and time as being separate beasts. We have something which we call space-time. They're no longer independent. And there's some weird things that can happen here, because let us imagine that we set it up so that here in the United States on the 4th of July one night, we would like to make a show for some aliens going by in a spaceship at a large speed, okay? And what we'd like to do for this show is to have the fireworks displays for every city happen simultaneously. So what does that mean? So that means, say, we decide that time will be, say, let's do it late. Let's do it at midnight Eastern time. If it's all going to happen simultaneously, that means Central Time, it better be at 11, and West Coast Time better be at 9. You with me? So everybody does it all at one time, on the hour, and so if you were at rest above Earth, you would look down and you would see all these little pretty blossoms all over the United States happening all at the same time. You good with that? Okay. Now, you're in the rocket ship and you're going at a large fraction of the speed of light. Everything in one reference frame is happening at the same time. So all the fireworks are going off at the same time. They're all in different places. The time that you would measure for them to happen would be very different if you were on the spaceship. So the whole idea of simultaneity now gets very complicated. We have everything going off at a simultaneous time in one reference frame, but because it's at different places and space and time get all mixed up, they are by definition not simultaneous in the other reference frame. Now you might worry about causality in this. It turns out that you can, in fact, reverse time ordering so long as they're not causally connected. If things could be causally connected, if light could have moved from one point to another and they could in principle be causally connected, then you cannot find a reference frame that changes the ordering of the time. But if they aren't causally, if they are outside of that region, it turns out that you can find reference frames which will actually flip the order of events in time. It's pretty weird stuff. Yes?
If there's a small, like very small velocity, like say the spaceship's moving at a small velocity, but the distances are huge, like the distance, the disparity in distances are big.
Yeah.
Like the different cities, then would it still be a big time disparity?
If the distances were big, so that it really took a lot more time for light to travel, right? Then yes, the spaceship would observe the things directly beneath it happening before things further away, because it would take time for that light to reach it. So that's true. But if the spaceship were moving slow, this gamma would be 1, and you would see it even without relativity. I mean, that's an effect you would observe in relativity. If something were emitted by the sun right now, and by me right now, mine would reach you almost instantaneously, and it'll take 8 minutes for it to reach you from the sun. But we don't need relativity to do that. That's true even in the Newtonian world. Okay? All right, so space and time are complicated and strange, and they are not separate. It is much worse than space and time, though, because, I mean, that is the place to start, but that's not the only thing you can observe. So it turns out you can observe all sorts of things, forces and energies and momenta and everything else. So it turns out that you have to have these transformations for any physical quantity you can actually measure. So people talk about making a physical theory relativistically invariant. That's sort of the physics catchwords. Basically, any theory we do, you have to have a relativistic version of it, which means you basically have these transformation properties. Otherwise, you've got a problem. So it turns out that momentum, which is mass times velocity in physics, so a car with big mass going slow can have a large momentum, or a small car going fast can have a large momentum. A big car going fast has an even bigger momentum. I mean, so there's your intuition about momentum. It should fit basically the English meaning. Momentum and energy have the same sort of relationship as space and time do in these transformations. And so, I don't know how easy it is to see, but basically, if you substitute T for E and P for position, you would see you get the same equations. Now, momentum is mass times velocity. And so what that really means is that when you get things mixed up here, you're actually mixing up energy and mass. And it turns out that when you look at these transformations and you go to the rest frame of an object, it still has energy. And that's a new thing that came out of relativity. People didn't think of an object at rest as sort of containing energy. But it turns out that it does. And that's called rest mass, and that is where this equation of Einstein's that you've probably seen before comes from. So what it basically says is that even a piece of mass that's sitting there has, in fact, a very large energy. And then the trick is there a way to make use of that energy? And that's sort of what led to the nuclear power and atomic bombs and such. So this was also a paper that Einstein published in 1905, but not the same one. Okay. What I wanted to do. All right, so you can get a lot of fun little strange paradoxes in relativity. Let's imagine that there's a farmer who has a barn, and he has a ladder that's longer than the barn. And so the farmer's sitting here scratching his head because he's disappointed that he can't get his ladder in the barn. Okay? And so the farmer has a son or a daughter, some student who's been to the university and learned all about relativity, comes in and says, "Oh, come on, Dad, no problem. I can fix you up, okay?" So what the student says is, "I'm going to go running really fast carrying this ladder. And you're standing there, so you will perceive this ladder to be length contracted. And you'll be able to, as I run through the barn, slam the doors, and the ladder will be in the barn." Okay? And the farmer's like really happy about this. Okay. So then this bright young student gets the ladder and is running along, going really, really, really fast, okay? And then realizes, "Oh shit, I got a serious problem here." Because the ladder is a certain length, and now as I'm doing this, this barn has come zipping by me at a large fraction of the speed of light, and it's length contracted. I can't get the ladder in that barn. What am I going to do? Who's right?
I have a question, actually. Is length contraction arguably a matter of just a perception? For some reason, it's easier for me to understand how time's relative than, like,
more power to you. I can't get either one. Yeah, it is all a matter of perception going from one reference frame to another. But it's totally real. So what do you think about the ladder paradox? Does the ladder get in the barn all at once or not?
All right, this might sound foolish, but if he's going with the speed of light, it tracks, right?
Yeah, he's not going to go the speed of light, but yeah, he's going a large fraction of it. So to him, the barn contracts.
Okay, so I guess since obviously he can't move the barn, what if he went like really slow, like inverse, almost the speed of light? So that would be big, right? It'd get bigger.
Well, if he slowed down and say he's at rest with respect to the barn looks bigger, but the ladder is still too long to go in the barn. So his trick was, if I go fast, then the farmer who's standing beside the barn at rest, he sees the barn unchanged in length, but now sees the ladder much contracted. So the farmer's like, what's your problem? Of course you can fit in the barn. I closed both doors while you were in the barn. And the guy who's running with the ladder says, wait, how could you do that? Because my ladder was way longer than the barn. You could not have closed both doors while I was in the barn. What do you think?
Well, when he's at rest, it'll just be longer than the barn.
Yeah.
Shorter than the barn for a period of time.
Well, yeah. So there is this whole complication of when he slams to a stop once he's in the barn, of course, the ladder has to bust the doors. They're both right. This is, and the answer to this turns out to be this weirdness with simultaneity. What do you mean when you say both doors are closed? The farmer sees both doors closed at the same time, they're simultaneous, at the moment that the person running has the ladder inside the barn. What does the other person see? The two doors are separated spatially. So in the Lorentz transformation, which is what we call this mathematical relationship between the two reference frames, remember space and time get all mixed up. So the fact that these two doors are separated in space means that they are actually closed at different times in the point of view of the person running with the ladder. So what the person running with the ladder might perceive, and I guess we'd have to work it out in detail to know, I guess it would have to be something like this. They get the ladder inside and the far door is closed, and then as they continue going, because you can't just keep him, otherwise he runs into the doors, the far door is open and the near door closed as the ladder goes through. So both doors end up closing, but at different times in that reference frame. So you can make consistency between the two points of view that way, as weird as that may seem. Okay, so there's another one, which is called the twin paradox. Two twins are born. You pop one on a rocket ship at the moment they're born, and the rocket ship goes off at a large fraction of the speed of light, and it comes back. But because it was moving at a large fraction of the speed of light, then time should have been dilated, which means this person ages much less than this person on Earth. When the twin comes back, this twin may have aged, 10 years. This one could be, depending on how fast you went, this one could be quite old or even dead. Okay? Well, from the point of view of the twin on the spaceship, I got plopped on the spaceship, I look out the window, and all of a sudden Earth takes off at a large fraction of the speed of light. And then it comes back. Weird thing, that planet comes back, and now I get out. From my point of view, their time should have been dilated, so the young one should be the one who is left on Earth. Who's right? That one's worse than the latter one, because first of all, in the latter one, you can imagine having the person running at a constant speed. But here you can't. You're because you connect at both ends, this you have to have acceleration. And so the problem is a little more complicated. You have to do general relativity in it. But people do, and when they do, it does break the symmetry in this problem. So it turns out that if you were to hop on a spaceship and go off at some large fraction of the speed of light and come back, time would have passed slower, more slowly for you than for the people on Earth. So time travel into the future can be done in principle. And you can go farther and farther into the future depending on how fast you can go with your spaceship. So modern physics is perfectly happy with that. Right, we can't go backwards in time. We don't know how to do that. So if you want to say bye to all your friends and family and you want to go into the future, in principle you can do that, but you can't ever change your mind. You'll never be able to go back. Yes?
If you were to like go to the future and then, or like get on a spaceship and travel the speed of light, when you come back, since time is slower on Earth, wouldn't it be like going back to the past?
No, it's the other way around. Time is moving slower for you up on the spaceship. No, it is true from your point of view. That's why since you're accelerating away from Earth, turning around and coming back, it's a different, it's not just a straight special relativity problem. So it's more complicated, so the asymmetry gets broken. Okay, so relativity is pretty weird stuff. Any more comments on relativity? We're going to be coming back to relativity periodically as the semester goes, but okay. So we've talked about Newton's laws, so acceleration and position and velocity and stuff. And if you want to actually calculate things, you really need, we talked about kinematic variables, you need Newton's laws, which relates forces to acceleration. And it turns out that forces are very important in nature, and we've talked a little bit about it in sort of a glib way, but let me actually tell you a bit about forces. So one force that you're very used to is the force of gravitation, right? And basically, if I do not support this with the force of my hand pushing up, then it's attracted toward the center of the Earth. It's accelerated, okay? And it's actually accelerated with a very particular value of acceleration, which depends on the mass of the Earth. And you're going to be looking at this in some detail in the recitation this week. You can actually take masses and a device that can measure the force between them with high precision, and you can vary the amount of mass and you can vary their distance, and you can try to be quantitative, to actually figure out how the force varies as a function of distance. And so there is a force which we call gravitation. It's one of the four fundamental forces of nature as far as we know, and the magnitude of that force is equal to some constant times m1 times m2 over the distance between them squared. So what do I really mean? Suppose I took a chunk of mass here and a chunk of mass here, and this one happens to have a mass m1 and so many kilograms, and this one has a mass m2, and let's say that they are a distance between them, which I'll call R, it turns out that the force of attraction between these two objects due to gravitation depends on the amount of mass. If I double the amount of mass here, it'll double the force. If I have the amount of mass, it'll have the force. And it's 1 over the distance between them squared. So if I double the distance, the force between them drops by a factor of 4. because it goes down by the square of the distance, okay? The other thing about gravitation is it is always attractive. We don't know of anything like anti-gravity. I mean, Star Trek may know about it, but in reality, we've never seen it. So this force is always attractive. And this the form of this force was actually determined by Newton. So it's another one of his major accomplishments. There's another force of nature which fundamentally is known as the electromagnetic force. And the electromagnetic force, I mean, you just don't run into it too often. If you do laundry, you notice static clean. That's a fundamental force of nature. If you rub things together, here are a couple of little conducting balls. And if I take some acrylic and rub it with silk, you can see that the ball was initially attracted and then it's repelled. If I once they're charged, it's really hard to get anywhere. See how they're running away? What happened was when I rub this, I deposit something called electric charge on it, which I would then deposit on the ball. If the electric charge has the same sign, then they repel. And now this has the same sign as the charge on the balls. I can't get anywhere near them. They run away. So you can see examples of lightning as an electric charge example. So to understand electricity, people came up with a law which is known as Coulomb's law. Again, you can take pieces of metal and you can deposit different amounts of electric charge on them and measure the force between two pieces of metal with different amounts of electric charge on them as a function of distance and see what happens. And when you do, in fact, you find a force law that's very similar to the force of gravity. In this case, it has nothing to do with mass. It has to do with electric charge, which I'm calling Q. But it's a very similar law. If I double the amount of electric charge on one of these, I double the force. This number and this number, they're just constants that basically determine what the strength of the force is. Once I choose units, if I'm measuring mass in kilograms and distance in meters, then the force is measured in a certain unit, and this is just a constant that sets everything right. So you don't need to worry about those. So people have done this quantitatively and understand this to be a force. Okay, so it's very real. I can do what I did with the rubbing, except do it with a mechanical device that does it really well and deposit a lot of charge on this piece of metal. So I basically have a belt that's constantly depositing electric charge on this thing, and as these strings get charged, they get repelled from the charge that's on the metal thing. So basically, you may have seen pictures of somebody with their hair sticking out when they get it really charged, so that's what this device does. If you get it close to You should be able to see sparks as the charge runs from here onto here. We say it's going to ground. Okay, so that's sort of the flow of charge through air. It knocks air molecules apart. Molecules are basically made of positive and negative things. So when you have a huge charge here, relative, it can rip the molecules apart. And then as they come back together, they can emit light, which is the color of the spark that you saw. So here are two of the four fundamental forces of nature. And we're going to talk about the others as we go along. But let me now ask you a question. I have a mass here. I have a mass here. This mass exerts a force on this mass. Or think charge, if you wish. It doesn't matter in both cases. There is a difference. The charge here can have algebraic signs, positive or negative, which means algebraically, this force can be either positive if the charges are the same sign, or negative if they're opposite signs. And that turns out to mean it can either be attractive or repulsive. So it's actually fundamentally very different from gravity. In gravity, there's only one type of charge, and that's mass. In electricity, we have two types of charge, positive and negative. And so mathematically, we model that with the different signs. So electromagnetic force sort of looks pretty much the same in terms of its form, but it actually can be both attractive and repulsive, so it's a little bit different. But either way, I have a mass here, and I take a mass, poof, it's here. There's a force on it due to that mass. From whence does that force come? From whence? Yeah, I mean, what causes that force? Is that force there if nobody's there to see it? How does the mass know there's a force that it should be feeling? Yeah. True, for different reasons, but we'll talk about the nature of the other forces soon. But yeah, they do. But what is it that causes this force? What is the essence of the force? I mean, just so these are fundamental. If I'm pushing on this, okay, there is a force, but what it really boils down to is the electromagnetic electromagnetic attraction and repulsion of molecules and things. That in the end, I can break it down into that. So, but what's the essence of the force? We're going to actually spend a good bit of time talking about different views of the essence of force, but the idea of Newton for gravity and of Coulomb and others for electricity or electromagnetism was the following. Basically, what they say is that if I have a mass here, it creates a condition in space, which I will call the gravitational field, where if I were to put another mass, it will feel a force of attraction toward this thing. It feels that force because the first mass creates a condition in space which we call the gravitational field. If we have charge instead of mass, it creates a condition in space I will call the electric field. Okay? So I have a mass here. A condition in space is created called the gravitational field or the electric field. I now put a mass here. It will feel the gravitational field, and that's what causes it to be attracted. Or it will feel the electric field, which will cause it to be attracted or repelled, depending on the relative charge signs. Does that sort of feel made up? It is, because I totally pull it out of thin air. Okay? It's really just a different way of looking at it. It's a hypothesis, a way of trying to come to grips with the fact that there is a force that is conveyed. So one way of looking at it is to argue, okay, let's not look at, let us assume that one mass creates a condition in space which we'll call the gravitational field, and now if I put another mass in space, it will feel a force. Which is basically force per divide out that mass. It will feel a force in the direction of the other mass, which I call the gravitational field. If I have a charge, Q, then we say that I have an electric field in space, and the electric field is basically the force per unit charge that is felt by a little charge if I put it at that point. This may sound pretty weird, so let me try to bring it down to earth here a little bit. A field is sort of a mapping in physics and mathematics. So you could imagine having a three-dimensional map of the temperature in this room at every point. Okay, it'd be a lot of points, but you could have, it may vary a little bit from place to place, and you could have a map of that. You could do the same thing for New York State, for example. If you were a weatherman, you might throw away almost all those points, but leave the points that represent the big cities and put them up on the wall, and then you'd have like a weather map. So, for example, you know, you could have different temperatures here, -5 in Buffalo, right? So you can have all these temperatures here, and these are a sampling of a temperature field, a representation of the temperature throughout space. The temperature is there, and so now you just create this one-to-one mapping. So this would be a field in physics or a field in mathematics. Here, you're measuring things that don't have a direction. They just have a magnitude. You can imagine having a field of something that has both a direction and a magnitude. So suppose instead of having a mapping of temperature from point to point across the state, suppose you had a mapping for every point, you had a mapping or a number which represented the wind speed and something that gave you the direction. So, for example, instead of storing numbers, you could store little symbols of arrows, okay? And the longer the arrow, the higher the wind speed, and the arrow points in the direction of the wind. So there, your mapping would contain not only the magnitude of the wind speed, but also its direction. So it's a little bit more of a complicated thing. And that we might call a wind field. In physics, we would call it a vector field, basically. But it's still this continuous mapping. So what we're inventing with the force of electricity is we're saying that if I have a charge here, there is an electric field in space that if I were to put a little test charge, it would feel a force both in magnitude and direction. But that force and magnitude and direction might be different at every point. That mapping is what we call the electric field. If we do gravity, it's the force the mass would feel in magnitude and direction. If it's closer, it feels a bigger force of attraction. If it's further away, that force drops off as 1 over r squared. It's always sort of coming in radially to the other mass. Any questions? Yes?
So if you have one mass and then you create another mass instantly at it, initially this first mass, as soon as you make the second mass will feel the attraction of the first mass. Does gravity move faster than the speed of light? So wouldn't it take time for that second mass to exert the gravitational pull on the first one? So you get this field extending.
Man, you got guys ask the greatest questions. Yes, yes. And, you know, if you want to become a physicist, you study that particular effect for electricity and magnetism in, like, your second semester of graduate physics. But, yes, it's a real effect. So yes, we believe if a mass appears all of a sudden at some point, it actually, the knowledge of that mass even being there basically propagates out in time. And we'll get there, but this, we can model this gravitational thing as a distortion of space-time. And so literally you make it appear here and this distorted space-time sort of wafts out at the speed of light. As a wave, yeah. So it's really weird stuff. So we've talked about space and time being all mixed up. We actually think of them in a sense as a fabric in general relativity. So we'll talk a lot about that. Yes.
So basically, electricity is like a wave, not.
It is. You can think of it as a field, and we're going to get to the wave-like aspect of it in a minute. But let me get the field picture in first. Yes, we will talk about electric fields waving in next class. So let's try to sort of get a visual of an electric field around a charge. If I put a positive charge here, if I were to take a little positive test charge and put it right here, it would be pushed away from this positive charge. And if I put it closer, it would be pushed away in the same direction, but it would be pushed more. So this arrow is a little longer than that arrow, but they're both pointing in the direction that little positive charge that I put at the base of those arrows would be pushed. Over here, they'd be pushed down. Over here, they'd be pushed this way. Over here, they'd be pushed that way. So if I were to now try to visualize the electric field surrounding this positive charge, it would look something like this, and it would just continue to go out, but the arrows would get shorter and shorter. Here, if it's a negative charge, it's the same thing, but everything is being attracted, because if I take a little positive test charge and I put it here, it's going to be attracted to the negative charge. Okay? And we can look at things that are slightly more complicated. So if I have both a positive and a negative charge, for example, and I put a little charge right here, it'll be pushed from this one and attracted toward that one. If I put it here, it'll be pushed away from this one, attracted toward that one. But the two of those things, sort of the piece of this one that's pushing it away up, cancels out with the piece of this one that's bringing it down. But both of them have a piece that's pushing it this way. So you end up with an arrow that just goes straight across. So you get a lot of strange things happening, but the visualization of the electric field around this combination of charges would look something like this. And it is a way of describing what the force would be in space around those things. And just to keep in mind, this is a hypothesis people pulled out to model this idea of a force at a distance. And there's nothing in this that says it's real at this time. All right? Any comments or questions? Let me do one. Oh, I guess I'm out of time. I'm going to have to stop now. So we'll come back to this and we'll talk a lot about the reality of these fields, whether they are or not. If you want to buy one of the books, we can do that now.